This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer. I'm Ruby Susan, joined by David Gale, as well as Paul McClure and Sarah Ramantanis. Tonight on The Informer, Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has suggested the plebiscite on marriage equality be delayed until 2017. The United Methodist Church has elected their first openly gay bishop in their Western branch, despite Methodist rules banning openly LGBTIQ clergy. But first, we're pleased to be joined by former Greens candidate for Melbourne Ports, Steph Hodgins-May.
About a week or so out from the election, we had a chat with Steph Hodgins-May from the Greens Party standing in Melbourne Ports. And I just thought it'd be a great opportunity to be able to catch up with Steph once more after a great campaign on your part. Steph, how are you?
Hi, Dave. I'm very well, thanks.
Pretty hard work.
yeah, it's a long campaign, and I suppose you don't quite anticipate having the scrutineering process happen at the end. So we thought the day after the election we might have had a result, but at present it's still undecided here in Melbourne Port.
So you haven't actually been on holidays on some tropical island for the last 2 weeks. What's been happening in that last 2 weeks?
The last 2 weeks I've actually been sitting in the AEC counting sort of headquarters lobby whilst a very eager and enthusiastic team of Green scrutineers watch the remaining votes get counted and keeping an eye on the numbers and fingers and toes crossed, and also obviously rejoicing some pretty positive swings right across Melbourne Ports. I think our vote went up in every single booth in the electorate, including in St Kilda, where we got swings upward of 10%, which is a really good sign that people are looking for some progressive green change in our area.
At the same time, it sounds like a bit of an emotional roller coaster because, you know, you were getting pretty close there for a while.
And the seat still hasn't been called.
Exactly.
What's the timeline for that, Steph?
Yeah, look, I expect that we'll know by Saturday. It's a bit of a waiting game to see when the votes are being counted. But look, I'd say at this stage, last time I checked, there are just under 4,000 votes outstanding that needed to be counted, and I expect we'll know by the weekend. And I will say that, look, it is likely that the Labor member will be returned, but we don't want to predict the outcome because there are still a few thousand votes to be counted and those micro-party preferences to be allocated, most of those micro-parties being progressive ones. So, yeah, I think
that
regardless of what the final outcome is, we do expect that this Melbourne Ports will be the most marginal seat in the country once we get those results, and that it'll be less than a percent difference between us and Labor. So certainly I think next election we're looking towards a Greens-Liberal marginal seat here in Melbourne Ports, which is incredibly exciting. But yeah, look, it is an emotional roller coaster. One day you're ahead, the next you're just behind, and you're managing your expectations, but also those of hundreds of supporters and volunteers who have often dedicated countless nights and weekends to working towards a green representative in the area. So, yeah, you're managing your expectations and theirs, but ultimately we're really proud of where we've gotten to and the fact that the voters have put their trust in us this campaign.
Ruby and I were talking this afternoon, and Ruby mentioned to me, oh, well, you know, either way, depending on if there was a recount or something, it wouldn't make any difference to the actual election outcome. But at the same time, it would make a difference to the parliamentary floor as to whether Owen Guest came through or whether Michael Danby or yourself came through. So do you think there'll be a recount done?
Look, I'm reluctant to foreshadow that. There is, a right, if it is within a certain margin, for any of the parties to call for the recount. We'll consider that when the counting has concluded and we see how close those margins are. But, look, yeah, it's certainly an option that is open to any of the parties. And it, as we've talked about previously, this is such an interesting seat, given that it is a three-cornered contest. And I know that last time we spoke, we talked about the multiple preference cards being handed out by the Labor candidate. And look, the Liberal Party have been there scrutineering closely as well, because they recognise that if we do edge in front of Labor, then Labor preferences are distributed, that they are also back in the race then. So it's an incredibly interesting seat to watch, and has been a cause of some confusion for a lot of political and media commentators.
Especially as some of those preference cards did put the Liberals before the Greens. And, of course, today at lunchtime there was a breaking story with The Age about some people that have been out vandalising all of the polling places on the night, or actually early in the morning before the actual election on the Saturday. So that's a bit of a controversy there.
Deeply troubling. When I send my volunteers out to overlook the materials on the night before the election campaign, you don't expect this sort of thuggery. And to be honest, I'm not entirely surprised, just given the tone of the campaign in general. From I personally have been the subject of significant slurs and untruths along the way. So
there seems to be quite a pointed attack at the women running for the Green seats during this election campaign.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, like it can wear you down a bit, and you've got to really learn to not take things personally, which I certainly have a thicker skin now than I did at the outset. But I just don't think it's the voters really. I think they expect a bit more from their federal politicians. And Mr. Danby's been in the job for over 20 years and, you know, win votes by having good debates over policy issues and a future vision for the electorate, not just name-calling. And this sort of conduct is just pretty appalling. And I really do hope that they get to the bottom of what's happened on that evening, and that we don't see this sort of behaviour in future elections, because it does deter people from putting their hand up and having a go. And I also hope we see more women candidates in Melbourne Ports next election. I was the only woman on an 8-person ticket, and I know that the Labor Party have never put up a woman in Melbourne Ports, and I think it's time for a change.
Well, having a go, you know, it wasn't just the 8-week campaign. You mentioned that, you know, there's really more or less an 8-month campaign. It's a very big thing. How does that take a toll on you personally? Because, you know, I believe the politicians, although we hold them up, they are actually, they are people as well. How does that take a toll on you personally?
Yeah, look, it takes an emotional toll. It takes a financial hit. I had to resign my job to do this campaign, and I chose to do that because it is a winnable seat, and I wanted to make sure that I gave it everything I could. But I'm certainly looking at my bills now and thinking, oh gosh, managing the finances. And I think any human, any political candidate would be lying if they said that it didn't take a toll at times. It's also rewarding in numerous ways. I come out of this election with hundreds of more friends than I had before I went into it. And even at the supermarket today, someone came up to me and said, well done, Steph. I don't know if you remember me, but we chatted at the voting centre, and I just wanted to let you know that after you gave some advice on childcare locally, my partner and I voted for you, and we're about to have a baby. And so you really, you're in the public both before, during and after the campaign.
It does sound like you made some pretty strong community ties there, Steph.
And also, you know, just seeing you at things like the Marriage Equality Rally, Ruby and I were both there, and, of course, you were standing there with your leader and, you know, the rest of the team from the Greens as well. You know, it's a very high-profile thing, but you have a lot of commitments during that period of just that 8 weeks, as well as the whole months.
But I do think it does look like it was something that the Greens' result in Melbourne Ports has been fantastic, you know, constantly increase in voting turnout there. But again, thank you so much for joining us and for talking
us
through.
Up.
It was great catching up, and it's great to know as well that you have come out the other side and would still encourage people to give it a go, which not everyone who goes through the process could really say.
Absolutely, and it's an incredible privilege, and I do encourage young women in particular, or, you know, anyone to give it a go. And my address details are on the internet, and I'd be more than happy to coach and talk to people who have an interest in being progressive political representatives to get in touch.
That's a generous offer. We'll see if anyone takes you up on that.
Thanks so much for being on The Informer tonight, Steph.
And thanks for your coverage throughout the election. It's an absolute pleasure.
Our pleasure too. Bye.
You're listening to The Informer, Joy's news and current affairs program. Last night during the ABC's 7:30 report, reappointed Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull has suggested the plebiscite on marriage equality might be held off until 2017. The Attorney General, George Brandis, had previously promised that under a coalition government, legislation will be passed by Christmas, which Turnbull then reluctantly agreed with during his campaign. Now, during the interview, Prime Minister Turnbull has named his proposed corporate tax cuts and changes to super as legislation he would put to the floor by the end of the year, prioritising this over the plebiscite. Now, Australian Marriage Equality Chair Alex Greenwich has joined us to discuss. Thanks for joining us today, Alex.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, the plebiscite was something that was decided under Abbott, something Turnbull has mentioned several times that he is not personally agreeing with, and yet now it seems to be in danger of disappearing entirely. What do you think's going on, Alex?
Well, firstly, I think what is really important is for the Parliament to resolve the issue of marriage equality through a free vote in both houses. The numbers look pretty good. This is something that the re-elected Turnbull government can achieve and celebrate the achievement of early on in their term if they wanted to. Now, we know that they are still sticking to their policy of a plebiscite, and the indications have been that it would be sometime early next year. In the scheme of things, that's probably not too much of a delay. You know, there does actually need to be a period of consultation, engagement with the various stakeholders, but I think it's also really important that people and supporters of marriage equality really get on the phone to newly elected MPs and really do what they can to encourage them for the Parliament to resolve this, because we don't need a plebiscite. It's unnecessary and it is costly.
There's been an article by activist Rodney Coombe about that issue as well, pointing out that a choice between nothing and a plebiscite isn't really a choice at all. But what I think is, what do you think about the? Do you think it is the same group of people that pushed for a plebiscite in the first place that are now looking to see it delayed?
Who knows what the political machinations are happening in Canberra? I'm interested in talking to some of the really great supporters of marriage equality across the political spectrum, who I know want to see the Parliament resolve this and want to see the Parliament resolve this as soon as possible. You know, we're in a situation where we've got, you know, good numbers in support of marriage equality returned, but we may have a situation where a plebiscite is imposed upon us. You know, it's not the gay community's choice to have a plebiscite, and I think we need to make that very clear. The LGBTI community's choice to have a plebiscite is not our choice.
Yeah.
If it is imposed upon us, we obviously want to make sure it is as fair as possible and make sure we run a campaign that wins.
For sure.
Look, it's funny because we all know that we don't want a plebiscite imposed on us, but it was up to John Howard to change the Marriage Act in the first place. Now, apparently this year there may not be enough time to be able to raise the legislation in order to enable a plebiscite this year, or apparently that's what the Prime Minister is saying. Apparently
Senate
there will be time
yeah.
for changes to superannuation and other things like that.
The important stuff, you know,
the
really
important stuff, and tax breaks for small business. Do you think anybody will possibly put up a private member's bill in the lower house, knowing now that we've got at least the numbers to pass it if it was a free vote?
At least 80, I think, confirmed.
87, I think.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, a good cohort of those will be coalition supporters who we need to, you know, who we will need to vote for the reform. And as we know, their policy is a plebiscite. I'm not sure if someone will put forward a private member's bill. What I would like to do, and it's something that I know happens in the Victorian Parliament, it happens in the New South Wales Parliament, it happens in the South Australian and Tasmanian Parliament, is MPs actually work together to achieve LGBTI law reform. And I'd like to see people from across the political spectrum in Canberra put down their party affiliations and really work together to get this done. You know, we've seen, you know, in Victoria, the apology was wonderful, seeing people from all sides of that parliament come together. In New South Wales, we've achieved lots of LGBTI law reform from cross-party cooperation, and I think now is the time for that. So let's have people actually work together and achieve a reform, which we can all then celebrate.
Do you think there is any backing up to the fear that this is the beginning of what might end up being a series of delaying tactics?
Look, I doubt there will be a series of delaying tactics, and the reason I say that is this Parliament elected some really true champions of marriage equality who will not let that happen. So, you know, Linda Burney is there, Louise Pratt is back, Lisa Singh got up in Tasmania, Tim Wilson, who is a strong advocate for our community, is elected, as was Trent Zimmerman, Warren Entsch is back. So, you know, we now have stronger support in the Parliament from both allies of our community and members of our community, and they're certainly not going to let this be delayed.
So why do you think that there has been that choice to, given it was an election promise, to go back on it so quickly?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, that's probably more a matter for the Prime Minister. I can imagine, though, that because a plebiscite is something that Australia has not had in a very long time, that they probably realise they need to look at the process in a bit more detail. I mean, what would the only thing that would be, you know, worse than a plebiscite is some kind of rushed, cobbled together legislation that has all sorts of problems. So, you know, now's the time for obviously the government to consult, but now's the time for our community and supporters of marriage equality to really get on the phone and the email to newly elected and re-elected members and do what we can to encourage them to deliver a parliamentary path to marriage equality.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Alex Greenwich. We do really appreciate it. That was Alex Greenwich, Australian Marriage Equality Chair. Thank you again. You're listening to The Informer. We just did get a text in saying that newly elected gay Liberals do support the plebiscite because they need to toe the party line. They mentioned Tim Wilson as an example there. And, yeah, so there is a belief that that may be a bit of a disagreement there. Now, you're listening to The Informer, Lass, and now we're going to be speaking about how this Friday the Methodist... the United Methodist Church elected their first openly gay bishop, the Reverend Karen Olivto. She's one of the three of the openly gay clerics to be nominated for bishop in the United States. Now, the Methodist Church does not recognise same-sex marriage or relationships and has a ban on open LGBTIQ people serving in the clergy. So the appointment has been met with mixed results, with some groups having expressed their joy at what they see as a historic moment, while others claiming this decision could push the church to the brink of schism. Tonight we're joined by Warren Talbot, the National Secretary for the Uniting Network in Australia. Thanks for joining us, Warren.
Pleased to be here.
So I have to admit, I am quite ignorant on the subject of the inner workings of churches. Could we start off by explaining how it is possible for an openly gay woman to be elected as a bishop when the church has rules against it?
Well, in a lot of the Protestant churches, it's not a simple hierarchy. So they can have a national policy, which unfortunately for the United Methodists is anti-LGBTIQ, but it's possible for regional conferences or state bodies to go against that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the appointment of Karen Olivetto as the bishop will probably go through their judicial processes. But it is quite possible within their system. It's not a simple hierarchy as in the Roman Catholic Church, where the Vatican can set the rules for everyone, as it were. There are national policies. I think it's worth pointing out that the United Methodists are now the only mainstream Protestant church that don't support LGBTIQ clergy. So they're the last ones of that group of churches who are holding out, and I think they're bound to give in.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't look like the holding out's working particularly well. They're infiltrating anyway.
Well, they're not infiltrating because of course we are members of all churches.
No, you're completely right. Now, I am curious, in Australia, and I know their Uniting Church has had two gay ministers lead congregations, but could you give us a bit more of an idea on how many openly gay people there are in the Australian clergy? I know the Anglicans came out with a pretty hard line in February this year against that.
Yes, unfortunately, the Anglicans in Australia have gone backward in that they're requiring gay and lesbian people who may be clergy to be celibate,
yep.
That is not to be sexually active. That's not the policy of the Uniting Church. In Australia, there are about half a dozen clergy in the Uniting Church are openly LGBTIQ. And by open, I mean open as in have been on page 3 of the Sydney Morning Herald or whatever.
Quite public,
open. Public, living in the manse with their partner, with their congregation and the appropriate authorities knowing the situation. There are quite a number, of course, who remain in the closet, and that people have to make practical decisions because sometimes it's not sensible to come out if you value your career or your profession as a minister.
For sure. What do you think this is saying? Do you think there is a chance this may cause a schism within churches as this becomes more and more of a dividing statement? Do you think we're going to see some of these larger groups start to split?
I don't think within the mainstream Protestant churches. In the US, the US Anglicans, Lutherans, Presbyterians, United Church of Christ, they all now have openly LGBTIQ clergy and leaders. And the United Methodists are the last ones to get there. So I don't think that's going to happen. And I think what the United Methodists will basically do is they'll find some way of saying we agree to disagree.
It's funny because it almost sounds like it's a generational change, and perhaps that the Methodists have kept elders within their churches that are maybe a little bit older. It's sort of a reflection of politics and general society in a way. But do you think it's because of an older set of elders or people that actually are in power in the church?
Well, that's true for Protestant churches generally. The congregations are all generally ageing. In this particular case, Karen Oliveto comes from the Glide Memorial Methodist Church in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and they were key in setting up an organisation called the Council on Religion and the Homosexual in 1964.
Oh, wow.
So they were forging a progressive path many years ago, so it wasn't a surprise to me at all to learn that the pastor at Glide Memorial had been consecrated as a bishop, because there are some people particularly on the west coast of the USA, who have been heading in that direction for many years.
Well, I do think it is sometimes difficult for people, especially us who don't have religious backgrounds, to see Christianity as moving in a positive direction. But it's clear that that is definitely happening right across the Protestant churches. Thank you so much for joining us and filling us in with some of the details we weren't quite sure of, Warren. We do really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thanks.
Once again, to find out what's happening in the latest news in the UK and Europe, we're joined by web editor of Attitude magazine, Will Stroud. Good morning, Will.
Morning, James. Lovely to speak to you as always.
And you. Now, last week we chatted about your incoming it was pretty much incoming and confirmed at the time, Theresa May, your new Prime Minister, and she's made some appointments.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the sort of ongoing political drama here in the UK. Obviously a new Prime Minister now this week. Theresa May, who's been, you know, after a very quick, you know, handover between David Cameron and herself, is now putting together her cabinet of ministers. So there's been some kind of notable appointments, really. There's been a sort of a lot of, LGBT MPs that have been, you know, that are in the cabinet, have been promoted to sort of senior ministerial positions, at least five of them, which, you know, is pretty good odds in a cabinet of, you know, ministers of about 30 people or so. And notably, actually, she's reappointed our education and education secretary and minister for women and equalities. So we've actually got a woman called Justine Greening now, mm-hmm. Who actually came out just 3 weeks ago during London Pride.
Ah, yes, 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 I remember that.
She's actually, yeah, she's now our sort of first LGBT minister for equalities, which is, you know, obviously, you know, great news to have, you know, a woman, a lesbian woman in the role.
Yep.
And as well, you know, her predecessors just caught a bit of controversy. Nikki Morgan, who hasn't been reappointed to any cabinet post, and she held up the Minister for Equality's position before, despite voting against same-sex marriage a couple of years back, which obviously raised quite a few eyebrows at the time when she was then appointed to the equalities role.
Absolutely. To the royals, and Prince Harry has got his finger pricked.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. This is big news here in the UK this week that Prince Harry, he carried out a sort of instant HIV test on Facebook Live. This was a live stream to the public. He went and visited a clinic here in central London. And, had an HIV test. It came back negative. But, you know, it did huge, great things to kind of raise awareness, I guess, and sort of, you know, break down fear and stigma surrounding going for an HIV test. Mm. He admitted he was nervous beforehand, understandable.
To be understandable, especially when it's live on Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of all ways to do it, that's certainly one that's going to up the pressure a bit.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's following footsteps in the legacy of his mother.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, both William and Harry have, you know, made AIDS and HIV awareness, you know, a big part of their work. You know, like Diana, who was, you know, famed for that during the sort of late 80s and 90s, her work with HIV and AIDS. But in terms of, you know, raising awareness, and especially in this way, sort of, you know, actively using something like Facebook Live and social media, you know, just really demonstrates, I guess, this new generation of royals, you know, the issues they are taking on. And, you know, he, you know, said before, he hoped that it would make anyone, whether they were sort of man, woman, gay, straight, black or white, you know, show that we're all equal when it comes to HIV and to get tested. And, you know, obviously, again, checking, you know, gay people is, you know, as small a thing as it is actually something that the royals have been criticised, you know, in decades gone by for not actually acknowledging the LGBT community. Mm. So, again, after Prince William appearing on the cover of Attitude just last month, you know, great signs about the sort of the issues that this new generation of royals are willing to tackle.
Yeah, absolutely. And just finally, Team GB are getting ready for the Rio Olympics.
Yes, absolutely. So obviously Rio just around the corner. We'll be all getting behind Team GB and hoping that they top Australia in the medal hall once again.
No, they probably will.
And two of the people that are competing, we do actually have a gay married couple on the Team GB hockey team. So it's Kate and Helen Richardson Walsh, who they actually met at the Beijing Olympics while playing together.
Oh, bless!
I know, it's incredibly sweet. And having played together at London, and since then, they've actually tied the knot. So, we're going to have a gay married pair on the pitch when it comes to the Olympics, playing alongside, alongside each other, which is, you know, to go, I guess, alongside an ever-increasing number of openly gay athletes that will be competing at Rio.
Absolutely. Web editor for Attitude magazine, Will Stroud, thank you again for your update.
Thank you very much, James. Always a pleasure.
Thank you to today's guests on The Informer, Greens candidate Steph Hodgins-May from Melbourne Ports, the Australian Marriage Equality Chair Alex Greenwich, and Warren Talbot, the National Secretary for Uniting Network of Australia.
And tonight's show was produced by Ruby and David, as usual, with the help of Sarah and Paul. Tonight's Ruby's last show on Tuesday night, so I want to say thanks to Ruby because it's been great having you on here. You're moving to Monday night. And, of course, The Informer will be on again tomorrow night at 6:30.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.